Good morning, everyone, and welcome. My name is Roger Swain, and it is my pleasure to welcome you to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum with today's guest speaker, Thomas Seeley. And please join me in thanking our musician today, Ted Mann. For many years, the Monadnock Summer Lyceum has been bringing outstanding world-class speakers to the Monadnock region to serve as a catalyst to inform, engage, and inspire an active citizenry on local, national, and global issues. As many of you know, the Monadnock Summer Lyceum programs are recorded for New Hampshire Public Radio. Today's talk may be heard on NHPR two Sundays from now at 10 p.m. The talk will also be available on our website, monadnocklyceum.org, as a podcast within a few days. After the presentation, in keeping with the Lyceum tradition, the speaker has agreed to answer questions from the audience. The ushers will be collecting your questions toward the end of the talk. Please write them on the yellow cards provided. Following the program, we invite you to attend an informal reception in the parish hall, which is through the door to your left. There you will have the opportunity to engage in further conversation with our speaker and to enjoy refreshments. In your pew, you will find a blue card. We hope you will give us feedback on today's program and join our mailing list and/or email list. You can either mail the blue card to us or drop the blue card in the bowls alone or with your contribution to the sustainability of the Monadnock Lyceum. The Monadnock Lyceum is supported entirely through contributions from our audience members. We deeply appreciate your donations, which may be placed in the glass bowls in the church and in the parish hall, and thank you for your generous support. Our speaker today is Tom Seeley, who will, in a moment, tell you wonderful things about honeybees. Honeybee colonies are founded not by a single individual, but by a queen and some 10 to 20,000 of her daughters who leave the hive in what is called a swarm. Capturing one of these swarms is a low-cost way for a beekeeper or a would-be beekeeper to stock a new hive. And the earlier in the year that a swarm is found, the more valuable it is, for the bees in the new hive will have more time to collect more honey. A swarm of bees in May is worth a load of hay. A swarm of bees in June is worth a silver spoon. But a swarm of bees in July isn't worth a fly. Tom taught me this rhyme. We were graduate students together in the same lab at Harvard, and our hives on the roof were stocked with wild bees that we collected in a practice known as grandstanding. School children, let out for recess, discover a great ball of bees hanging from a playground branch. Panicked adults call the police or the fire department, who in turn telephone a number on their bulletin board. The beekeeper then shows up, dressed in t-shirt and shorts, no gloves, no veil, simply a large paper bag or cardboard box, and positioning either one under the swarm, he or she simply gives the branch a firm shake, dislodging the bees and collecting the entire swarm. No bravery is required. Bees in a swarm simply don't sting. But the admiring crowd doesn't know this. You know, you're an instant hero. That's grandstanding. The adulation of the terrified public was quite enough for one of us. But Tom went on to discover exactly what honeybees look for in a new home. And after years of brilliant experimentation, he knows precisely how bees make this most critical real estate decision. Tom, this swarm is all yours.
Thank you, Roger. It's wonderful to be working with you together again. Lovely introduction. Well, I'm going to build on what Roger just described, this swarming process. Those of you that are beekeepers know that we've long observed and lamented the tendency of our colonies to swarm in late spring, early summer, this time of year. And as Roger just explained, when this happens, the majority of a colony's members, this crowd of 10,000 or so bees plus the mother queen, flies off to produce a daughter colony, while the rest of the colony, the remainder, stays at home and rears a new queen to perpetuate the original colony. And as Roger explained, the departing bees usually settle on a tree branch in a ball about the size of a soccer ball, and it's a beard, it looks like kind of like a beard, and they hang there together for a few hours or even sometimes a few days. And during this time, these temporarily homeless bees will do something truly, truly amazing. They'll hold a democratic debate to choose their new home. And so what I want to do today is I want to share with you how honeybees collect this democratic or collective decision-making process. I also want to share with you what general lessons we humans can learn from the honeybees about how to organize our own group decision-making processes. So the key here is so that the knowledge and the brain power of all the members in the group can be harnessed to make important decisions, good collective choices. And this is an important issue, not just for the bees, but for ourselves, because we humans often rely on groups to be more reliable than individuals when it comes to making weighty decisions. That's why we have boards of trustees, juries, blue ribbon panels, and 9 justices on the Supreme Court. But, as we all know, groups don't always make smart decisions. In fact, they can sometimes make dreadful decisions. And the key here is that unless a group is properly organized, it's apt, in fact, to be a dysfunctional decision-making body. But fortunately, the house-hunting bees show us a brilliant solution to the puzzle of what gives a good group decision-making process. The bees offer us such a good model is what they've been doing in choosing their homes is a process that's been honed by natural selection probably for millions of years. And so it's definitely a time-tested method to achieve collective intelligence. Now, I'm certainly not the first person to investigate this process, so I want to take you back a little bit. Go back about 70 years, because the story that I'm going to share with you today is rooted in Germany. It started in the summer of 1944, when a professor of zoology at the University of Munich made a revolutionary discovery for which he would have eventually received the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine. The professor was Carl von Frisch, and his discovery was that an insect, a worker honeybee, can inform her hive mates of the direction and distance to a rich food source, a patch of flowers, such as a milkweed patch, and she could do this by means of a dance behavior. We call this the waggle dance, and I brought with me a little friend with whom I can demonstrate what the waggle dance behavior is. In performing a waggle dance, a bee does this on a vertical surface, the comb inside the hive. And what she will do is she will waggle, rotate her body, basically pivoting at the top of her head, back and forth, as she walks up the comb. Or it could be down the comb. I will come back to that. So she'll do a waggle motion, and then she'll stop after a certain period of time. Then she'll come back around, and then she'll do another waggle motion. Then she'll stop again, come around the other way, and she'll keep doing that over and over and over. And what von Frisch discovered is that when a bee is doing this, she's producing a miniaturized reenactment of her flight from the hive out to the flowers. So this waggle motion is like her flying out. And she, to indicate the distance to the target, she adjusts how long each of those waggle runs lasts. If it lasts a second, it's about quarter of a mile away. If it's 10 seconds, it's several miles away. And the bees can time each of those waggle runs. And then the angle of that she does her dance, whether it's pointing straight up or whether she's waggling straight down or waggling to the this side or to that side, indicates, specifies the compass direction. And the bees can watch that and get that information and go out the right direction and the right distance, and they'll find that patch of flowers. Now, that was an amazing discovery. But while von Frisch was decoding the waggle dance of the honeybees, he had a student, a graduate student, named Martin Lindauer. And he's actually my main predecessor in this whole story. Lindauer is a key figure in this talk because it was he who pioneered this study of the democratic collective decision-making by honeybees. And the way he made his discovery was that he had a talent, he had a knack for noticing little things that turn out to be really revealing and important, lead to big discoveries. His most important observation of a little thing occurred in the spring of 1949 at the Zoological Institute at the University of Munich. He came out of the institute and he saw a swarm of bees that had collected in a bush by the front door. It was, again, about the size of a soccer ball. And he noticed several bees performing waggle dances on the surface of the swarm. And by this time, von Frisch had deciphered the waggle dance, and so he first thought, oh, these bees are advertising food sources. But then he looked closely and he saw there were a couple of things that were odd about these bees that were doing these dances. What caught his eye was that they didn't look like foragers. None of them carried loads of pollen on their hind legs. None of them regurgitated loads of nectar to the other bees around them. And instead, many of these dancing bees were dusty looking and dirty. And when he plucked one of them, one of the ones that was black, looked like it was black with soot, he plucked it off by grabbing the bee by her wings and he brought it to his nose and sniffed her. And he said, he smelled the aroma of a chimney sweep. This is back when there were chimney sweeps. And Lindauer went on to investigate this process. He suspected that these dusty and dirty bees were scout bees. He knew that a swarm of bees was looking for a home, and so he suspected bees were doing waggle dances not only to advertise food sources, but also, in this context, to advertise potential home sites. And that could be in Munich in 1949. This is shortly after World War II, and Munich was bombed almost to a pile of rubble. These could be an unused chimney here or a fractured wall there. And that's why that one bee was sooty. She had found a broken chimney. And his hunch was they were advertising those by performing these waggle dances. So what he did is, the next time one of the colonies at the university, at the Zoological Institute, cast a swarm, he got permission to just not go out and quickly gather the bees and do as Roger described, get them into a box or into a hive, but just to let them hang there so he could watch them. And he went out with a little paint set so he could put identifying marks on the bees. He went out with a stopwatch, a notebook, a pencil, and a chair. And that was about it. His equipment was very simple. And he would label each bee that he saw dancing on the swarm and noted the direction and the distance of the site that she was advertising. And these swarm-side vigils led Lindauer to a very surprising finding, that he discovered that when the swarm first settles and he's looking at the dancing bees on the swarm, he sees that they're indicating many different locations with their dances, a dozen or more, widely separated all around the city of Munich. But after a few hours, that diversity of dancing condensed onto one site. So all of the bees were indicating one site. And shortly, within maybe an hour after they had come to that agreement by the dancing bees, the swarm would take off, and he could run, and the swarm, when a swarm flies, it's about the size of half the room here, fly, and it doesn't fly very high. The bottom of the swarm cloud is about the length of the room, the width of half the room here, and the bottom of the swarm cloud is only about 6 feet off the ground. So he was able to run along beneath the swarm like that's the swarm. And in many cases, not all, but in many cases, followed them to their destination. And he found that every time the bees went to exactly the location that was indicated by their dances. So he knew that, yes, these dances, they were conducting a debate with their dancing to choose their new home. But the most remarkable thing that he found here was it was very clear that this decision-making was distributed among many, many, many bees. It wasn't a decision made by any one leader bee, and it certainly wasn't the queen bee. She's hanging out in the center of the cluster. So it was, and he was the first, he called it a plebiscite. I like to call it a democratic form of decision-making. Lindauer published his findings, his beautiful story, I should say, about the house-hunting bees in the mid-1950s. And over the next 20 years, nobody followed up on this investigation, even though it was a fascinating story. Maybe everybody thought the story had been fully told. Or I think more likely, though, the problem was that the paper he wrote was written in German. So it wasn't accessible to many people. Most of the people looking at bees were English-speaking. When I was a undergraduate student at Dartmouth in the early 70s, I read a little book in English published by Harvard University Press in which Lindauer had a chapter where he summarized his story about the house-hunting bees. And it was a series of lectures he gave at Harvard. And I found the whole book fascinating, but especially that chapter on the house-hunting story. And in reading it, I quickly realized that it's only like 8 pages. I realized he was just summarizing his results. So I knew I had to go read his original paper. I looked it up, found it, nice, big, long 62-page paper. Unfortunately, it was, of course, in German. And I didn't know German. So what do you do? Well, I took a course in German. And painstakingly, in my spare time, I went through it and translated this paper, which is called Swarm Bees Out House Hunting. It was slow work, but it was utterly fascinating. And as I worked along, it became crystal clear that Lindauer's pioneering investigation of this decision-making process provided us with just a very preliminary understanding of the subject. Because, like all good scientific studies, it raised many more questions than it answered. So when I started graduate school with Roger in 1974, and I had to choose a topic for my PhD research, I knew I wanted to deepen Lindauer's investigation of how a swarm of bees chooses its home. And I made a start on that for my PhD research, but the most important work I did was done, I had to wait for the technology to develop. We didn't have computers back then, we didn't have video cameras back in the 70s. The investigation really took off in the mid-90s when the technology of digital video recording became available. And so it was that digital video recording, which enabled me to record all of the dances on a swarm. Plus, I had devised methods by then to be able to label each bee in a swarm for individual identification. It's basically gluing a little license plate on the back of all 4,000 bees in a swarm. And so it's possible to get a very fine-grained picture of what exactly those scout bees are doing. And I also had one thing that Lindauer did not have. I had access to a 90-acre treeless island off the coast of southern Maine, Appledore Island. It's the largest of the Isles of Shoals, which lie 6 miles out from Portsmouth, New Hampshire. And the beauty of this island is that by being 6 miles off the mainland, it's too far for the bees to go back to the woods on the mainland because it doesn't have trees. It didn't have natural nest sites. As we see, that's a slight exaggeration. It didn't have many natural nest sites, and so I could control the bees' real estate market. And so with that situation, you can actually do experiments. You can offer them different boxes. You can, a good one, a bad one. You can see how they make the choice between the good one and the bad one. You can boil the whole process down into the basics. Appledore Island is the home of the Shoals Marine Laboratory. It's a joint venture of University of New Hampshire, thank you, New Hampshire, and Cornell University. And because it has no hollow trees, doesn't have large trees, it was all grazed down in the 1800s and then was used by the Navy in the Second World War, has no big hollow trees, it gave me a place where I could control this real estate market. But it wasn't completely without alternatives to my experimental nest sites. One alternative, for example, included the chimney of the house of the resident lobster fisherman, Rodney Sullivan. So I soon learned that each year, step one in setting up for that summer would be to climb to the top of his house on a ladder with some old window screen and some duct tape, and fasten the screen over the opening of the flue of his chimney. The first summer I was there, I didn't know to do that. The bees liked his chimney. It was the closest thing to a big, tall tree they could find. And even though the flue is an opening in the roof, that was the best they had. They liked that. Rodney was freaked out and was happy to discover me, that I could help him. And just to seal the deal, I'd always deliver a couple of jars of honey. Those of you that are beekeepers know very well that a one-pound jar of honey or two is a great way to build goodwill, especially with a fairly crusty Maine lobster fisherman. So what I studied most closely on Appledore was exactly how the several hundred scout bees, I mentioned a swarm is at 10,000, 20,000 bees, about 3 to 5% of those, so a few hundred, several hundred bees are the scout bees. These are the oldest, most experienced bees in the swarm. They're the ones that make the decision. So that became my focus, and my question was, how exactly do they work together to find the possible home sites and then choose one? What I want to do now is I'll summarize how the scouts in a swarm work together so that collectively they make a good choice of their new home. In essence, they have to do three things to pull this off. And this will sound very familiar because it's when you think about it, it's what we do when we have to do elections and things like that. We first have to identify a diverse set of candidates, of a diverse set of options. And we've all just watched that over the last year as the two parties went through and tried to identify the candidates for us to vote for. So step one, identify a diverse set of options. Step two for the bees is each site by the bees is found by an individual bee, and now she has to share that information freely so that all of the options, in a sense, are put on the table. If a bee finds a site but doesn't advertise it by doing dances, it's as if she didn't find it. So they have to share the information about what they find. And then thirdly, and this is the most complicated and tricky one, they have to aggregate or process this information to identify the one best site. So, okay, let's go through these things. How do they identify a broad set of options? And when you're doing a search, I should have mentioned this earlier, for the bees, this is a life or death decision. Honeybees are unique among insects in how they get through the winter. Unlike all of the other insects in north temperate parts of the world, they don't hibernate. They don't go into diapause. They don't let their body temperature drop. Instead, they go through the winter by making a cluster, and they produce heat with their muscles, the muscles that power their wings, and they produce heat at a rate of about 40 watts. And it's and they make this tight ball of bees producing 40 watts of heat, and that heat production combined with their excellent natural insulation of all these fuzzy bees means that they can keep the ball of bees where the core temperature is about 95 degrees Fahrenheit, like our body temperature, and the outside stays above 50 degrees. But for that to work, they have to be in a well-protected cavity so they don't have a lot of wind and cold air blowing the heat out of that ball of bees. Plus, they have to have enough honey stored away to fuel that heat production, that 40 watts of heat production, 24 hours a day for 7 months, basically from the end of October, maybe through April. And so they need about 50 pounds of honey. So they need a cavity that's snug, not drafty, but also quite spacious. So they, when they go house hunting for a home site, they have to find a place that is about 1.5 cubic feet in volume, in other words, a large hollow in a tree. But curiously, that large hollow has to be paired up with a tiny little opening, about an inch, maybe an inch and a half in diameter, a knot hole. And ideally, they will find that knot hole high off the ground, 15, 20, 30 feet up off the ground, so black bears aren't apt to notice it. And ideally further to top that all off, they'd like to have that entrance face south. So in the winter, on a warm day in the winter, their entrance is sunny and they can go outside on what beekeepers euphemistically call cleansing flights. So they can go out and do their business. So they have to find, step one is to find a diverse set of options. And fortunately, they all share that criteria. They all know what they want. And how do they do this? Well, they do it by marshaling several hundred scout bees. Each scout bee flies out on her own. Some go north, some go south, some east, west, some go nearby, some go miles away. They will search out for several miles from where they're clustered. And the bees will be searching for potential home sites. And you can see these bees at this time of year out in the woods or even around buildings in a town like this. You'll see a little bee going up and down a tree or poking along the edge of a building, looking for a dark opening, searching for an entrance to a potential home site. And they do this search they can do very effectively because there's several hundred individuals. On the Appledore Island, for example, if I put out my experimental nest boxes, it usually only took them half a day to find these boxes. Now, 90 acres doesn't sound like a large island. It's not a large island. But think about what they have to find for the experiment. They have to find a little hole in a funny green box on that island. But they will do it. And it's a good demonstration of the power of their ability to find a broad set of options. And as I say, no two bees are searching the same area. So some will find an abandoned woodpecker nest here. Another will be looking in a building over there for a crack in its walls. So starts out, bees go out, hundreds of bees go out. About two dozen of those bees find something that's worth reporting. And then they come back, and now they will share their discovery with the other scout bees, all the other bees that didn't find something. And they do this, they do a very good job of freely sharing the news of their find. And when she comes back to this cluster, she will, with the waggle dance, she'll be indicating the direction by the direction of her waggling. She'll be indicating the distance by how long she does the waggling. If it's a short waggle like that, it's nearby. If it's a long waggle, it's farther away. And there's one more thing that she does. So she's indicating, there's three Ds here. She's indicated the direction to the site she's found, the distance to the site she's found, and the third one is the desirability of the site she's found, the goodness of it. Because, as I said, the ideal site is that one that's up 1.5 cubic feet, little entrance near the bottom of the cavity, but high off the ground facing south. They don't all meet those criteria. So some are first class, some are medium, some aren't so good. And the way they express that desirability or goodness is how many of these circuits they make. If a bee finds a really good site, she might do two. I've seen one bee that even did more than 300 dance circuits. It took her about a half an hour to do that. She just danced and danced and danced and danced. But most bees don't find something that is first rate like that. And they might come back, instead of doing 100 or 200 or 300 dance circuits, they might do 10 or 20 or 30. And some just come back and barely squeak out one dance circuit. Fortunately, they're honest about, they don't overstate things. And even if they did, I don't have time to get in this, but even if they did, and made a mistake and advertised vigorously a not so good site, that error doesn't get propagated. Because the next bee the bees that follow those dances, they go out, they check the site themselves, and they will inspect it, make their own evaluation, and they will come back and they will advertise it as well. But they will advertise it based on their own assessment. So if the first bee overstates or understates the quality of the site, that gets sorted out. One thing I want to stress is that every scout bee is free to advocate whatever site she finds, even one that's, as I say, a relatively poor option. And so in a sense, on a bee swarm, all views are welcome and respected. All opinions may be voiced. And the reason I stress that is I think we've all been in group meetings where you have an idea, but you're wondering, well, really, should I propose this or not? Well, if we follow the model of the bees, you would. Because you might not think it's the best idea, but it might turn out to be, in fact, a very important suggestion. Okay, so now they've gone out, they've searched, they've identified a broad set of options, they've done that search independently, they've come back and they're sharing their information. Now they have to process it. I've got this bundle of dancing bees, some going, indicating north, some east, some west. How do they, and some better and some poorer. How do they focus, build a focus on the one best site? Well, they do it in an ingenious way, and it works rather like a political election, because when you think about it, there are multiple candidates, the nest sites. There are competing advertisements for the different sites. Their advertisements are the waggle dances. There are individuals that are committed to this candidate site or that candidate site, and those are the bees that are dancing. They visited the site and they're reporting on it, advertising it. And there's a pool of undecided voters, scouts not yet committed to a site. And also, and this is also very important, the supporters for each site can become apathetic about their site. They can drop out after a while. And this means that sites that, and this happens especially, is more likely to happen if the bee is coming back from a poorer site than from a first-rate site. So there's a natural process whereby the interest in the poorer sites, not only it dies out, as well as it doesn't get propagated as strongly because the dances for those poor sites don't last as long. So, in the case of the bees, the election outcome is biased strongly in favor of the best site. Because when you think about it, this site's scout bees, its supporters, will honestly and accurately produce the strongest dance advertisements and thus will gain additional supporters most effectively. And ultimately, interest will be building up for the one best site while the interest for all the other sites is dying away because they can't compete with the building growing a crescendo of interest for the best site. Ultimately, the bees that are supporting that winning site, it's usually the best site, 99% of the time it's the best site. Ultimately, they will sense that their site has reached a critical level of support. And we call this a quorum. Enough individuals are supporting, advocating that site for them to have a reliable indication that that site has passed muster with enough bees to be the winning site. Once this happens, the bees from that winning site, they start walking around on the surface of the swarm. They no longer do the waggle dance. Instead, what they do is they come up to other bees and they make a different signal. They'll grab another bee with her forelegs. She'll press her thorax against that bee and she'll make a piping sound. And that is a stop. It's a signal that says, we call it the piping signal, but it means decision has been made. And she will do this to all of the bees in the swarm because it not only tells the other bees the decision has been made, but that they should start warming up their flight muscles, start warming up their engines to take flight. After about 30 minutes or 60 minutes of this signaling, every bee gets the message. And when these bees from the winning site sense that everybody's hot enough to take off, they do another signal called the buzz run, where they burrow through the other bees, breaking up the cluster, breaking up this ball of bees, getting everybody to launch into flight. And once everybody's airborne, then the little scout bees that know where to go, they'll shoot through the cloud of bees like this, pointing the way to the new home site. And once they reach the front of the cloud, they'll fly back and zoom through again, pointing the way. And thus they can steer the swarm to the new home site. And then somehow, mysteriously, and it'll fly along about 6 miles an hour, top speed, somehow, and this remains a mystery, when they get to the chosen site, starting about 80 yards ahead of that, they somehow are able to put the brakes on the swarm cloud. So it slows down. It's going in the right direction, right speed, and then it starts slowing. So it comes to a stop right in front of the tree that will be their new home. And then these scout bees, just a few hundred of the thousands of bees, they drop out of the cloud, they go to the entrance or the knothole or the crack, and they release a chemical signal that marks that as the site and then everybody flies and can start moving in, including, of course, the very important queen. And what I want to stress is that, just to review this, because it gets me to my last point, I want to stress that the scalpies in a swarm have aggregated their information about their options by conducting an open debate in which the best site prevails in this popularity contest by virtue of its superiority. And it's judged superior, when you think about it, time and time and time again by dozens, if not hundreds, of independently judging scout bees. No scout bee ever gets enthusiastic about a site simply because she's seen a bee do a strong dance for that site. It's always based on her own personal assessment of the site, and that is key to good decision making, having the individuals decide independently. Well, to summarize, I want to make reference to one of Shakespeare's plays. It's called The Life of King Henry V, and in it, the Archbishop of Canterbury, was he Episcopalian? I don't know. Probably not. Acknowledges the quality of the honeybee's social order when he states, "For so work the honeybees, creatures that by a rule in nature teach the act of order to a peopled kingdom." What he was telling Henry V was, you can go off and fight your battles in France, but things will keep humming along like a beehive back here in England. It wasn't good advice, but it was actually true advice, especially in relation to the bees. Because if I understand now, and I've used this knowledge when I functioned for 5 years as the chairman of my department at Cornell, and by following the five rules that I'm just going to share with you, I think we were able to make that department a little less like a hornet's nest and more like a bee swarm in its when it came to making decisions. What are the five things? Well, these are the things that if you're the moderator or of the group, if you can do these things, your group's going to be a good decision-making unit. First of all, work on issues where you can see and can make it clear that there's a shared goal. If people want to go in different directions, then you're not in a situation where you're going to have good group decision-making. And that's we've all seen that in our elections. But if you're in a difficult situation, you might all want to have the shared goal of hiring the best person. You may not agree about what area it will be, but I focus on the shared goal, because if you've got that, then people will understand they're going to be working together, not apart. Secondly, if you can, to the extent you can, organize the group so that the group's members possess diverse information. That's what the scalpies did. They went out, searched independently, got different pieces of information to bring back to solving their decision-making problem. Thirdly, encourage sharing of the group of the individuals to share their information freely. This might involve just going around the room and saying, I want to hear what everybody has to say on this, what ideas, what proposals. Sometimes it's the quiet people that if you don't do something like that, sometimes they have the best ideas, but they would not be heard. Fourth, have the group members debate strongly, have an open, after going around and hearing about everybody's ideas, I want to say, okay, let's kick these around. I want to hear what people think about these different things. And then, as part of that stage, have people vote independently. And that we saw again with the scout bees. No bee just tags along on somebody else's opinion because they saw somebody else held that opinion. They went out and formed their own opinion. And then finally, if you're doing a voting process, which is secret ballot, which is an excellent way to get independent assessments, then you just have to aggregate those votes in an unbiased way. We humans are really good at this. One vote per person, majority rule, quorum sensing, something like that. Well, those are what I call the five habits of highly effective hives. They work beautifully with the bees, and they can work really well with humans. And I've studied a little bit New England town meeting, and on certain issues where individuals are working together trying to figure out how to make their school system work well, because they all want that to happen, I've seen these same things happen. So this is not just about bees, but about humans as well. Thank you very much for your attention.